part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Well, I mean, I know you have a show to get back to, so we should probably just begin
an
interview.
Yeah, sure.
What convention are you at? Just curious.
I am at MizCon. It is MissoulaCon.
Okay.
So it's right here in town, which is neat.
And is that like a 3 or 4 day con or something? Memorial Day, like all that?
Oh yeah, it's a 4 day con.
Swallows
so it's
the
extra
weekend. Wow.
Yeah, it's the whole weekend plus, and it's extra exhausting. So
sure, absolutely.
I am currently, you know, Lindsay left for the con at like 9:45.
Yeah.
So I am at home and I'm just kind of chilling and I'm like,
oh gotcha. Oh, so you're not in a hotel or anything like that. Gotcha.
No. I'm just home talking to you and I'm like, this is great.
gotcha. Well, let's get you off to the back to the convention. I just, you know, sometimes you want to let people know like what conventions people do or what they're doing. Obviously, this will go up after, you know, you're done with the convention, but if you do it next year, or just to give a good shout out to the convention and let people know, you know, what you're doing. So that's great. That's really cool. I 4 day cons are heavy for me. Like I'm just like sitting at that table all the time, but we're not here to discuss conventions. We're here to talk about, well, let's just say that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. This is episode 501. We've made it past 500. Last week was episode 500. So we're entering, I don't know if we should say like entering a new era or epoch. I don't know, whatever. They're just made up benchmarks, people. But in any case, welcome to episode 501. I have JL Draco on the line. You are one of the, like, would you say co-publishers or co-owners of Oneshi Press, or like, what's your title there?
You know, we tend to go by co-founder.
Co-founder, okay.
Yeah, and I think that the term has a little bit of a sense of like built-in sense of legacy to it.
Yeah.
Like we founded this thing together, but it's going to go beyond us, you know?
Got it.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, your name is JL Draco, and you're usually on with Lindsay G, but she's at the convention this morning, which is totally fine. We can have a a grown-up discussion on the line. Yeah, maybe. Well, we're talking comics. Would anything be grown-up? I don't know,
there's some pretty adult comics we could talk about.
That is true. Well, we're here to talk about Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter, which is currently running on Kickstarter, the third chapter, correct? And is this the finale to the series? Am I to understand
that? This is the trilogy finale, and it was written to be a trilogy when I first outlined this series. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. So we know zombies are involved because it's in the title, but how about letting people know what Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter is about?
So Mr. Guy is a half goblin doing, you know, all kinds of freelance gigs in the gig economy, just getting by, you know. And one day he's doing a cow sitting gig, and he's on this, you know, ranch at night, and it's dark, and he gets bit by a freaking zombie. And that's his like introduction to zombies. Like, what? This dude just bit me? What the hell? You know?
Yeah.
And so it turns out that on his modern day fantasy world, there is now a zombie apocalypse. So we combine a lot of ingredients and hit the ground running with that, right?
Yeah.
As you said, like, you know, zombies are in the names. So we know that he's a half goblin. So that automatically invokes, you know, a sense of like Lord of the Rings, D&D, you know, Warcraft, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So it's high fantasy. And he's in a suit holding a shotgun. So it's modern day high fantasy zombie apocalypse. But also, you know, the cow sits up and comes at him. And so, like, it's
zombie comedy, cow, right?
Know? Oh, yeah, zombie cow.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So we have a high fantasy modern day zombie comedy.
Yeah.
And that's in a nutshell what Mr. Guy is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's also a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. I mean, if you're listening to this and you've already heard Goblin and like D&D and Zombie Cow and you're not automatically in, like, I don't know, like, what more you need, like, to know, you know? Yeah. I mean, you were nice enough to send me the first two chapters and I read through them and I very much enjoyed them. I think this is very much like in line with people who would like stuff like Deadpool or like maybe the old She-Hulk comics and stuff like that. Like, it's very sort of like self-referential, like breaking the fourth wall, like stuff like that. Like, it's comedic. It's not necessarily horrific, right?
Oh yeah. No, it's definitely, it's way more comedy than anything else.
Sure.
All of those other genres are like the backdrop for the comedy.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you're not laughing out loud while reading this, like, check your pulse. You might be a zombie, you know, like,
yeah.
And so, you know, with that, talking about these other genres being a backdrop, I also do lovingly lampoon a lot of, like, you know, just favorite pop culture touchstones. You know, like, we kind of shred them, but in like a loving way, satirically. Like, there's, you know, references to like Resident Evil, there's references to, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. Dusk Till Dawn, Night of the Living Dead, even like Lovecraft and you know, all kinds of stuff. Dante's Inferno, like, they all just, if you've heard of it and it's a big deal, we probably at some point have lampooned it.
Yeah.
At least if it's like appropriate for, you know, a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we have shoehorned things in.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, it's funny because we've chatted in the past, obviously, a couple of times on this podcast. And it sounds like you're a fan of many things, but I mean, like, obviously there's a love for, like, I mean, I love zombie stuff. I love, like, zombie, not every zombie movie, but I like the genre. Like, you know what I mean? I love the Romero, you know, the original trilogy and stuff like that. I'm assuming that you enjoy that stuff as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. I haven't really, like, bothered to reference anything that I don't enjoy, you know.
sure.
So there's like the kind of satire that like takes things apart and makes fun of them because it doesn't like them.
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of satire that makes fun of things because it loves them.
Yeah.
You know, this is the latter. This is definitely like a love letter to all of the, you know, those things that were just like monumental in for me growing up, you know, in my development as a storyteller. So I get to play with those settings. And actually, so that's the other thing about this, is that each one of those settings that I play with is kind of a different little mini arc, a little 8-page kind of chapter.
Yeah.
So the way I break this up is acts. So each book is like act one, act two, act three.
Yeah.
But there are 12 arcs, and each arc is focused on lampooning a different story or a different, you know, genre or mythos. And because of that, I tried to write each arc as like kind of self-contained, even though it's part of a larger ongoing story, but with a little bit of a different style.
Yeah.
And I hunted down the artists from my roster and picked the ones that I thought would be the best for each arc. So, you know, if we're going into, we go down into Heck, and, you know, Dante from Dante's Inferno, he was guided through hell by Virgil. So now it's his job to guide Mr. Guy through Heck. And, you know, I picked the artist, James Groling. I was like, oh man, your sensibility, your sense of humor, your styles, like, you're going to do this arc just right, you know? And so for all 12 arcs, I've done that. I've picked people that I think are going to do that arc just right, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a very different approach to storytelling. And it's almost, I hate to say it, but it's almost a hard sell because it's kind of radical. You know, like people are like, wait, what? You know, like no one, like even a lot of times you'll have anthologies, but they're usually written by different people each act. And yeah. It's not one cohesive, contiguous story. It's, you know, multiple stories that are connected by a kind of backbone thread, right? This is literally one story, and it's just shifting morphs every arc. So I took that risk. I rolled those dice. It might make it a little bit of a hard sell, but so far, anyone that's read it that I've talked to has been like, oh my God, this is great. When's the third one coming out? You know?
Yeah.
So it's like the hard sell, but the solid hook, you know, like the hook is solid. I just, you know, it's difficult to talk about in a way that's like easy to get your mind around without seeing it, you know?
Well, it's interesting because I remember when you both told me about this and you were like, Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter, and you're like, it's an anthology series. And I was like, okay. And I got it. And I was looking through it and I was like, oh wait, JL wrote all of this. Like he wrote every story. And like you said, it's a different artist on each chapter. And that was one of the things, I don't know if we've discussed this or I know I've discussed it on the podcast, but when I was a young comic collector, like, you know, scraping my dimes and nickels, like this was back in the day when they were like 50, 60 cents, 75 cents and stuff like
that. You had to like dodge Tyrannosaurus Rexes to get your comics
exactly. You know, or parents who didn't want you to read comic books. You know, I was not a big fan of the anthology because like the reason that I bought anthologies was, well, I read comics a lot for the art. Like I got into them for the art and I was like, this is the artist that I really like. And if I bought an anthology, like I was like, oh, I may like this art, but I don't like this other art. And now I've spent like whatever, 60 cents or, you know, my precious dollar.
Yeah,
or
your precious dime.
Dollar 25. So can you speak to me about how you approach anthologies? Like, cause obviously it seems like you're a fan in a way, right?
Well, so yeah, I am. I'm a fan of anthologies. I definitely still have taste, but usually my taste is based on, you know, what I think the editor, the spearhead of the anthology is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my first real introduction to anthologies was back in the 80s. It was Turtle Soup. And that was a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles anthology.
Oh, nice.
And it was different writers and different artists. Every few pages, it would just suddenly be different turtles.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a second, what? I got like angry the first time, you know? I was like, no, that can't be. Why did it change? I was digging that, you know?
Yeah.
And then like, you know, I just kept looking at it and I was like, oh man. And then I saw there was like a Stan Sakai, a Yosagi Ojimbo crossover was in there. And there was just some great art in there. Different writers, different sensibilities. But the more I hate read it a few times, you know, because it was so off-putting to me. But at the same time, I was so curious.
Yeah.
And the more I read it, the more I loved it. And I'm actually staring at my copy that I've had since the 80s in front of me right now.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
And this is, you know, Turtle Soup number one. And there's like a intro, I believe I don't remember if it was Laird or Eastman who wrote the intro, but there's this really beautiful, I'm afraid to open it because it's so old, you know, but there's this really beautiful intro talking about this vision of like, you know, kind of just playing well in the sandbox with others and how it would be so nice if like we could pass characters back and forth and see how other people would do them. And yeah, it was like really beautiful, really well written, and really inspiring, you know?
Yeah.
And shortly after that, I had gotten into Heavy Metal magazine.
Okay.
And I started going to yard sales, and I'd get 5 at a time, 10 at a time, until I completed like the last, you know, 10, 15 years of heavy metal and had every single issue. You know, it was huge, two huge stacks of heavy metal magazine.
Wow.
I was like going completionist on it, you know, and I just loved like that every few pages was like a different kind of awesome, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, heavy metal was like a thing unto its own, right? Like that was
Yeah,
a rarity in the comic book market. You know what I mean? Where you were just like, I mean, European artists, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, what I loved was that they would have continuing stories that were broken into short little...
Oh, that's true, yeah.
You know, snippets sometimes.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they would have self-contained little vignettes. And, you know, we've done that with our Onishi Press Comics anthologies, where a lot of the stories that you'll read in there are self-contained vignettes, but some of them are continuing stories that every time we're launching a new anthology, we get the next installation as a submission. And I think that that's just really fun and cool. Nice. But, you know, another part about this is I have always loved, like, when I go to, like, a buffet, like one of those super buffets or grand buffets or whatever, you know, I love trying to get, like, two bites of everything on my plate. Can I do it? You know, can I fit just like a little bit, like one or two bites of this, one or two bites of that? Can I fit everything on my plate in a way that then I can taste each thing separately, one at a time, and just go down the list and be like, oh, that's what that tastes like. Oh, that's what that tastes like. I just love that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to like fill my plate with General Tso's chicken. Like, I want to have like a bite of General Tso's chicken, a bite of sweet and sour chicken, you know what I mean? Like, or whatever. Like, bite of chicken and broccoli, like some of that, you know, shrimp and broccoli, or, you know, like, I just want to try it all. For me, like, I really have a lot of fun with that. Not always. Like, sometimes I want to sit down for one single meal where I know what's going to be on the plate and I know that it's going to be what I like, you know. And we have our series, like Tracy Queen or Pack, that are very solidly, like, Lindsay is the writer, I am the illustrator, you know what you're getting, you know? Like, I appreciate that, and I love that, and I do that. But also, you know, I like to see what other artists will do with my character sometimes. And that's, you know, there's a little bit of maybe, like, self-gratification that I get out of Mr. Guy. But, you know, I've gotten a lot of feedback where people are like, oh, it's so cool to see that this character's design holds up and that he's the same character regardless of who's drawing him, like all these different artists are drawing him and it's still him.
There's,
you know,
definitely a consistency still there. Yeah, between stories and stuff that works, so that's really good. One of the things that's interesting to me too about this book is, like, obviously within the past whatever 10 15 20 years, like, zombies have just exploded onto the like, it's just become mainstream. Right, like, whereas When I was growing up, it was like, what? Zombie movies? Like, who likes to watch that? Like, you know what I mean? And now you've got...
Why would you want to watch that?
Exactly. Oh, it's so scary or gross or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, and then it shows up on AMC, Walking Dead, and just, like, takes the world by storm. But the thing is like, there's obviously, like, an oversaturation of the market. And that's one of the things that your book, like, really avoids, because it is, like, unique and, like, different and interesting. Sure. Like, I've been doing this podcast for a long time, and every once in a while I'll get somebody and it's like a zombie book and I'm like, okay, here we go. Let's see, like, what's
all
coming.
Right.
Like,
strap, you know, in. Yeah.
Yeah. Strap in. And when I look at this, I'm like, okay, there's this, like, green guy on the cover and he's got a shotgun and he's wearing a suit. You know, I'm like, what's going on here? Can you talk to me about the steps that you made? Like, was this conscious? Was it conscious to, like, where did the half goblin come from? Like, where, you know, there's a bit here where he actually gets bitten in the first chapter and something different happens, you know, stuff like that. Were you consciously being like, I need to do something different? Or was this just like an idea that popped in your head and you're like, let's just go with that?
So a lot of it actually developed when I was a kid working on it, like a teenager. And with that, at first, it was just a doodle in a sketchbook, and I just wrote Mr. Guy next to it, you know? It was just like a rather immature, you know, like before I really knew anatomy or anything like that. It was just a funny little doodle of a funny little Mr. Guy.
Yeah.
And originally I tried to work him into our Children of Gaia series with Chris Covelli. And I think what happened there was Mr. Guy, I mean, the name is already silly, right? Uh-huh. So Mr. Guy became more cartoonish and sillier, and Children of Gaia became more serious high fantasy. And so they kind of diverged, you know. It was like they got to the point where it was just not fitting anymore, and it was like, ah, man, I really love Mr. Guy, but he just doesn't fit in Children of Gaia, you know, like it just isn't working. And so then I was like, wait, what? I just give him his own story, like whatever, I can just draw him for fun in his own story. And so I did, and I kept that alive. And then, I don't know, circa 2003, 2004, somewhere around there, I tried to draw it traditionally as a comic book. That would have been my first attempt at making a comic book. And I still have it. It's actually right in front of me as well. It's not good, you know? I the character designs are good. It was hand-lettered. It wasn't like plotted out, it's sloppy and juvenile, but the heart of it is still the same,
yeah,
as the Mr. Guy that we see now, you know. And so what I realized is, as you develop on your artistic journey, as with anything that you do enough of, you get better at it, right? And that's execution.
Yeah.
But execution and heart are not the same. You know, yeah. Like you don't necessarily get better ideas as you go. You get better ways of conveying your ideas. You get better techniques. You get better tricks. But your ideas are your ideas. And so, like, sometimes mining my childhood for ideas, like ideas that I had as a kid, I'm like, man, that's such a great idea. I just need to draw it as an adult and it'll come out good. You know, like,
sure.
So I do a lot of that. And that's kind of where mostly Mr. Guy came from. But, you know, something you said, I'm trying to think. It's like the, why would you want to watch that? I feel like, you know, when I was a kid watching Night of the Living Dead in black and white, you know, it was just stone cold horror, you know. Yeah. It was just these things just coming at you slowly, and no matter what you did, they just kept coming at you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the genre at large has been co-opted by people with power fantasies that feel like might is right and brutality wins, and in the zombie apocalypse, only the people that have a real killer inside will win, because you have to be able to kill everyone because only the edgelords survive. And it's like, if you think about it realistically, those people are going to kill each other in the first freaking week. Those people that are like just totally amosexual and totally like, you know,
amosexual. I've never heard that phrase. What is that? That's great. Can
amosexual?
You clarify?
It's people that like only feel good when they have more ammunition, more guns.
I figured it's something. You know, like, yeah, yeah.
You know, people that just get off on the ability to murder.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I think that the zombie apocalypse is like, oh yeah, you could just shoot people in the heads. You could just kill people. You could chop people up with a machete, but it's fine because they're not people anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea of whatever you're doing is fine as long as they're not people anymore is one of the most dangerous ideas in history.
Yeah.
Like that idea is how empires have existed, where people just move in and mass murder an entire populace and feel okay about it because they're not people anymore.
Yeah.
You know, dehumanization is such a horrific, horrific scar on our species, you know, like it really is. And the truth is, if there was a massive apocalypse where something like that happened, only the most collaborative people, only the people that can really play well in the sandbox and can really form tight bonds would survive.
Yeah.
All of the people that are like, oh, you know, like gotta go trigger some libs or whatever, like they're gonna fucking kill each other right away.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the people who are like making friends and figuring out how to farm and figuring out how to take care of each other and figuring out medicine and figuring out, you know, herbology, since like synthetics in laboratories won't exist anymore. Like only those people who are really good at communicating and really good at sharing ideas and are really in touch with their emotions are going to live.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the first thing that happens in that kind of high stress environment is people that are not in touch with their emotions lose their shit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So for me, the idea that like edgelords are the only people that'll be left in the zombie apocalypse is just so absurd. It's like obscenely ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to have like, well, what about in this zombie apocalypse where it's like, you know, Mr. Guy, he's freaking super liberal. He doesn't care. He's like, hey, as long as you're not being a dick, as long as you're not trying to bite me, like, what does it matter to me? You know, like, do your thing.
Yeah.
And that's not to say like, he's got like a sense of justice, but he's a little bit of the fool character. He's got that open door policy, like whatever door opens, he goes through it, you know. But the story itself, I never try to say like any of that edgy stuff. And this isn't like a realistic survivalism story. It's a cartoon. It's it's fun and it's funny, but I do, you know, make it a point to like put in jabs of that like kind of bully mentality, you know. Like I'm always punching up, always punching the punchlines are at the expense of people who think might is right, people who think that like, you know, being a dick is cool, you know, because it isn't. It's not cool. Like being nice is cool, you know.
And so
I was like, well, there should be zombie literature with that concept as like the first and foremost concept.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's hard to say because this isn't a hard zombie. Like it's not zombies on Earth in modern time. It is cartoony.
It's not survivalist mode or anything like
Castle
that.
Castle Bigmark, however, at the end of the second book, there's Castle Bigmark, which was originally a poem that I wrote, and then I turned it into a spoken word song.
Uh-huh.
I wrote it sometime around, like, I think 2005. I turned it into a song around 2010. And then around 2020, I worked it into Mr. Guy. So it's been with me for a while, you know?
Yeah.
And that originally had nothing to do with fantasy. It was just about survivalism. And just this idea that, like, you know, the collaborative survive. People that can collaborate survive. People that compete just become zombies. You know, like, they're already zombies. They just haven't lost their pulse yet, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like the idea in Shaun of the Dead, right? Where it's like we're just shuffling around in our lives, not really experiencing things. And what's the difference between us and the undead, right?
Right. Yeah, I really enjoyed Shaun of the Dead a lot as a deconstruction of the genre.
Yeah.
And I feel like genres need to be deconstructed. Otherwise, they get bloated and fester and become, like, I feel like the zombie genre has become a zombie into itself, you know? Like,
yeah, on its own. It won't stop. Like, yeah. How long is this going to keep going? How many series of Walking Dead can they make? Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree.
It just doesn't have a pulse anymore, you know? Yeah. It doesn't have a heart anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, just, like, everything is so sick, bro, you know?
Yeah, well, everything is so serious, let's all flex.
You know?
I mean, it's interesting. I love that you're bringing up this concept of, like, community and as like being the survival thing, because I think that I recall listening to either the Radiolab podcast or This American Life, and there is this new thinking in evolutionary theory, which is like, it used to be like, oh, you know, Darwin, like, might makes right, or like only the strong survive. And what a lot of people have started, scientists, whatever, anthropologists, sociologists, they've been like, sure, no, it's actually the people that learn to cooperate that survive, the people that learn to like put their differences aside and work together that actually survive. It's not like just the people that had like the best weaponry or the biggest guns or, you know, whatever. It's like the people that, you know, thought, you know, in a different way than everybody else was while they were all trying to kill each other. Right. So yeah, you're on the right track there for sure.
And like, you know, it might be advantageous to have a couple of edgelords in your community, but like, you keep them on the outskirts of your community, protecting from outside, you know, dangers.
Yeah.
You don't want them like in the heart of your community because they're just going to cause problems.
Yeah.
You know, like they are not the heart of the community. Like, yeah, it's probably fine to have a couple of those people who are like good at being dicks, but like, put them in the outposts, you know, keep them away from the kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, and there's a great book, actually, Survival of the Friendliest.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So, like, Darwin never said might is right. Darwin, you know, talked about survival of the fittest. And fittest can mean anything. People have taken fittest to mean the edgiest, you know, the most brutal, the sickest.
Yeah.
But, like, really, the fittest could be the person who is the best at healing.
Yeah.
You know, the person who's the best at farming.
Yeah.
The person who's the best at teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
The person who's the best at sharing what they've learned with others. That could be very well be the fittest in most cases, you know?
Yeah.
And so yeah, we really need to get rid of that idea, you know. Like like that whole thing with like alpha males, you know, who are like so sick, bro. Alpha males is like such an erroneous concept because it's not like it comes from a false view of wolf packs and then has been applied to humans falsely. Like humans don't operate that way and wolves don't either, you know, but like it's really just a way of people who I think are afraid of doing the emotional work to get in touch with who they are and why they're acting this way. And, you know, like they're afraid of doing that work. And so they want to justify it.
Yeah.
Instead, they justify the lack of work they've done on themselves by glorifying it and being like, nah, bro, it's so cool. It's so cool. I have no idea what's going on inside me. You know? Like,
yeah.
Like, no, it's not cool. It's like really immature, actually, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely an interesting.
You know what I mean?
Oh, no, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, no, fine. You go for it.
No, no, I mean, this is definitely an interesting sort of like thing that I've been thinking about a lot and kind of discussing with people too, as far as like the whole kind of like broification of, you know, whatever, superheroes or comics in general, where it's like, ugh, everything's got to be. And I was even in a conversation with some people yesterday talking about stuff like The Dark Knight Returns and like hanging out with nerds is great because you end up in an hour long conversation about like Batman and Superman, what, you know, and it's just like the other tables are like around you in a place are like listening to you. And they're just like, what the fuck are these people talking about? But it's just, it's interesting how like, I was saying like, I love like The Dark Knight Returns, despite the fact that I dislike like just about everything that it spawned afterwards. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
in comics.
Yeah, totally.
But
Absolutely. As
a book itself, like I love it. Like I think it's like really well done and well put together. And, you know, obviously I have my issues with Frank Miller and what he kind of developed into like later in his career and stuff like that. But, you know, there are certain aspects of that book that I just love, but hate like everything that came after it. Like, you know, like I love The Watchmen and, but I hate like everything that just like literally was like, oh, let's just make everything exactly like this and take the wrong messages from it. Like, you know what I mean? And
the wrong messages. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's great. That's great. But I mean, I want to discuss more about your book, actual, you know, Mr. Guy Zombie.
Oh yeah,
Hunter,
sure. I'll go on any tangent.
No,
so.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think this is great.
You gotta rein it in on me.
It's good for people to hear. But one of the things that I like, and I think the character's name is Spooky, you do something different with the zombie bite. Can you discuss a little bit of that, or is that too spoilery, or like, I mean,
no, nothing is too spoilery. I am like a ninja when it comes to talking about my plots. If I feel like something has a spoiler in it, I'll talk around the spoiler.
Yeah.
You know,
But Spooky's so like his Jiminy Cricket, right? Like his like conscience.
Kind of, yeah. And it's like, so in the first chapter, we get a flashback from Mr. Guy's memory, Guy's point of view of what happened with him being cursed and infected.
Yeah.
Later on, we actually do mention like Spooky's like, yeah, that's how you remembered it, you know? So we do get a hint that maybe Mr. Guy is not like the perfect, reliable narrator. But his recollection is that he gets bit, and because that zombie that bit him accidentally offed itself, now its ghost is haunting him. But there might, in fact, be more to it, and that doesn't really make sense based on anything else that they've seen, witnessed, or learned.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's also like a lingering plot hole that needs to be figured out.
Okay. And is that something you're wrapping up in three?
That would be a spoiler. So, we'll say that three wraps up Mr. Guy's Zombie Hunter and leave it at that.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
And there is a little bit of, you know, I do love the dissatisfying ending of like Conan the Barbarian or Conker's Bad Fur Day or Chronicles of Riddick, you know. There's a little bit of that like, wait, what? You know?
Like open-ended sort of thing?
Maybe. You know, maybe.
Gotcha. Gotcha, gotcha. Well, one of the things I also like about your books, I mean, we talked about this in Pack and when we just were talking about Pack and the things that you sort of like interject. I mean, you talked about like Dante's Inferno a little bit and stuff like that. There's a bit of, I don't know how else to like express it, sort of like social consciousness or things that you're trying, there's Tarmac's ads in this book as well and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Can you speak to like addressing that sort of stuff in your book? It's like, I don't think anyone should be sort of scared off by it because I think it's very clever and interesting the way that you sort of approach these things. But even just talking about like what we were talking about before with like edgelords in the zombie apocalypse, you definitely have a point of view in your book.
Sorry, books. I hope I didn't scare away any of your fans with that.
No, I don't. I mean, I'm a California liberal. I can't imagine that anyone has, you know, vote for Biden. I say it all the time.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, you know, please, God, just vote for Biden. But I can't imagine that anyone, you know, if they're listening to me, they're hate listening.
They'd still be
probably.
Listening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm just, sure. Or they're, you know, plotting vengeance on me in some way. Like, I don't know. But,
they're,
you know,
they're hate listening and they're just in their bunker with all their ammo. Hate listening.
Yeah. Putin's bad. Nazis are bad. White supremacy is bad. Trump is bad.
Right.
Just please vote for Biden. He's not the best choice, but, you know, whatever. I'm a California liberal.
He's the choice that we have.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you know. What I want is ranked voting, because then we could have someone who's third party win, even if they get second place on both sides.
Yeah.
So ranked voting would be dope, but we don't have that right now. So right now, we just got to make sure Trump doesn't get it.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Have.
Just like do the best with what we've got right now. And,
right.
You know, in any case, can you talk to me about interjecting your sort of, you know, point of view into the book? Because I mean, I wouldn't say it's necessarily heavy-handed or anything, but it is there. And the walking through the, you know, nine levels of hell, I was like, this is very clever and interesting the way that he's addressing certain issues, in particular, you know, sexual assault and stuff like that, or people who are anti, you know, like approaching people differently by their gender. You know what I'm talking about.
Bigots.
Can you speak to that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, bigots. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I took a course in college on the Inferno, Dante's Inferno.
Okay, cool.
And it was an entire course on just that one book, you know?
Yeah.
And so we really went into the deep dive and deconstruction. And, you know, at the end of the day, like a lot of people have taken that book to be like apocryphal information about religion.
Sure.
You know, like people are like, oh, I know this, that, and the other thing about hell. And it's like, yeah, that came from a fiction.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
the heavens, you know, like, what do you know about anything? You know,
like the Bible.
What
exactly.
does anyone know about it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
We're on the same page.
You read it in a book.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and reading it and learning about a lot of the things in it from a both a deep dive literary examination, but also historical, you learn that a lot of the things, a lot of the places people were put, those were like people that Dante didn't like in real life, or political adversaries of Dante's, or, you know what I mean? Like, these are all of Dante's biases, the writer, you know, all of his biases, all of his likes and dislikes were all put into, categorized in hell. So he basically like just put all of his bigotry into this book.
Okay.
You know, that's what the Inferno is. It's like a categorization of how much bigotry he has about certain things, you know, like, and the more he hates this, the deeper in hell it goes. And it's like, wow, dude, you're really kind of unhinged, you know. But it's also a really cool, like, so much cool aesthetics has come from it, and so much interesting, you know, ways of approaching things and writing and ideas. So, like, there's a lot there that's really cool.
Yeah.
But really, we can't ignore the fact that he was kind of just being a dick, you know? And so I wanted to take that apart and show the cool parts and show the cool aesthetic and all that, but also, like, take some of the shittiness out of it, you know? Like, filter it a little bit. And, you know, for me, like, the idea that right in the beginning, like, everyone who's a good person but doesn't know to believe in Dante's version of the Christian God,
yeah.
you know, like, goes to hell anyway, even though they were a good person. So there's a whole level of hell for people that were like, oh, you were so awesome, but you just didn't believe the right religion.
Yeah.
You know,
like, what?
Like, what? That's crazy.
I remember
absolute
being
absurdity.
Yeah. Being young and, you know, having Jewish friends and growing up Catholic and being like, wait, they're going to, like, this doesn't make.
They're going to go to hell?
Like, what? I like that guy.
No
like,
way.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what is.
Yeah.
That's
totally.
Ridiculous. Like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So I kick it off with that layer, limbo or whatever, you know, is empty because it's a layer for non-believers. But it turns out that non-believers don't actually have to follow these rules. So it was kind of a big oversight, you know, like, no one's there because,
that was,
you know, if
clever.
You're not a believer, it doesn't affect you. So it was like, you know, and that's the kind of humor that I continue to roll with for that arc is just like the deconstructive humor, you know? And, you know, also things like, for example, like lust, the layer of hell for lust that's supposed to be in, you know, modern context, most people would think, oh, like sex workers go there, people who, you know, are poly go there, swingers go there. And it's like, well, lust actually comes from lux, which is the root for luxuria. And that really refers to people putting their own gratification ahead of the greater good. And what that means is someone who's like, yeah, I could like help the entire world right now, but I'd really like to build rocket ships and be the first corporation to go to Mars.
Yeah.
That's lust. That's lust.
Yeah.
You know, that is a better sense of lust than two or three or four consenting adults having a good time. Like, that's not lust. That's just having a good time. That's like, hey, you know what I mean? So, like, the fact that these words have been twisted over the generations little by little, and in the Dark Ages, very abruptly at some points, you know, like, literally anyone who refused to accept the new definitions was murdered in the streets by the church, right? So, like, you have some pretty dark history there of people intentionally corrupting the words of prophets who are just like, you know, prophets, another word for like, hey, wow, this unbelievably wise person, you know, like, has become this deification that like, no, only we're allowed to tell you who prophets are, and only we're allowed to tell you what prophets have to say, and anyone else, you know, that's a heretic. So, you know what I mean? It's like, whoa, wait a second, whoa.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to deconstruct there. And I've also taken courses on that and, you know, history around those things without getting too specific, because I don't want to, you know, they say when an egg cracks from within, life begins. When an egg cracks from outside, life ends. Oh. I don't want to crack anyone's egg, but, you know, there's a lot to examine there.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I love that aspect of your work and your company's work, which is kind of like, you know, to use a British expression, like taking the piss out of stuff. Like, you know what I mean?
Where yeah, it's
like
totally, very much absolutely. Like,
I don't think that there's enough like comics out there, or even just, you know, stories out there these days that do enough of that. You know what I'm saying?
Just like take it down a notch.
Yeah. I mean, I love the ads and stuff, like the Tarmux ads, and there's like a, what is it, D-Mart or something? Like, I'd have to scroll through.
Castle Big Mart?
Yeah, Castle Big Mart. Yeah, there it is, Castle Big Mart.
Well, Castle Big Mart is actually the survivors who take over a Big Mart. They turn it into Castle Big Mart.
Oh,
but
so
the
like,
store
itself
is just Big Mart.
Gotcha.
And Big Mart's also mentioned in PAC, you know, they talk about how, like, you know, food holes become Big Marts and, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Groceries become like Big Marts and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's just corporate gentrification.
Sure. Talk to me about the ads in the book where it's like he's a dirty dancer, chicken wrestler, and it's like that sort of thing that you, those things that you see around town where you have to pull off a tab or like, you know, did you use those anywhere? Or
in the first chapter, he has this like, I didn't always used to look this way, you know? And so you're assuming like, we're going to find out why he's green. Right.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I used to be a chicken wrestler, a dirty dancer, a mech pilot, nothing unusual until one day, you know? And it's like, wait, what? Like, that was meant to just be like a one and done joke. But then I was like, wouldn't it be funny to like put in the ads for those things that he just listed? Like those just odd jobs from before the apocalypse.
Aspic chef.
Yeah. So I continue it through the second and third book where I just keep coming up with, you know, various odd jobs that he did before the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Part of that is just, you know, myself as someone who's been a freelancer since the late 1900s, you know?
Like, yeah.
Feel like I have done more jobs than most people, you know? Like, I just, you know, there's that thing where you've done so many different kinds of things. You're like, wow, you could pretty much put me in, you know, any number of situations and I'd be able to like at least find a little bit of a foothold, you know?
Yeah.
So for Mr. Guy, I was like, let's make him like someone who does odd jobs and that's it. You know, it's just whatever for some scratch, you know, like strange for change, you know?
Yeah.
And so
strange that, for change. I like it. Yeah.
That, I feel like was just a way of building his character, but also kind of just making absurdist jokes. There's a little bit of like Dodison there, right? Like sure. I love to just be like, he's a chicken wrestler. Get your chickens wrestled. Like, wait, what? Why would I get what? You know, like that kind of humor that just makes you just kind of laugh because you don't know why. You know, like there's a lot of that. And we do more of it in Act Three, and it's even for me, some of it's like, all right, I jumped the shark with that one. I better make that the last one. Or, you know what I mean? Like, there's some pretty good ones in there.
Sure.
I think.
Sure, absolutely. No, they're great. Okay, so one of the things I did want to ask you about, and I know you got to get back to your convention, so I don't want to keep you for too long. You know, hopefully this isn't too broad a question, but as an artist yourself, you wrote a lot of these, and I think you illustrated one chapter, at least in the first act. How do you find your artists and how do you find working with artists, being an artist and writing your own stories? Like how has that experience worked for you?
So, you know, most of the artists, well, first of all, I wrote all of Mr. Guy. I wrote the whole thing beginning to end. And I did write the intro, or I did illustrate the intro and the first act, and then, you know, pass that torch. And everyone who's in there is someone whose art that I admire, is a person that I admire. Many, if not most of them, have had work in one of any number of one of our previous anthologies.
Okay.
I do sometimes use our anthologies as like work rosters. Like sometimes I'm like, ah, who do I get to do this? And I'll just flip through my anthologies and be like, oh, that person.
Yeah.
They were great to work with and their style fits. And you know what I mean? So there's a lot of that. Also, I'm always on Twitch. I stream every Tuesday and Thursday night. I stream my art process. So while I'm working on stuff, I'll live stream that.
Nice.
But then whenever I'm working on stuff and I'm not live, I will have another streamer up on my on one of my monitors while I'm like drawing this or that. I'll be watching someone else.
Got it.
I'm always also watching other live streamers. And you know, it's a community and you get to know other people and you get to see who's good at what. And I don't believe that like this artist is sick and that artist could do better. I believe that people are different and on different places in their journey. Sure. Some people might be like, that artist is juvenile. That artist has been doing art for 40 years. You know,
yeah,
there's a difference there. But in terms of style, I think some styles are appropriate for some types of storytelling. Some styles are appropriate for others. And you'll see that in Mr. Guy, there's very different styles.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that any of them are like necessarily not up to par with the others, or, you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't say that any of them are like better than the others. They're just different.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I noticed too, while going through the book, is that none of them seem like, I mean, There might be like one or two like sections, but as a whole, I don't think that they diverge like so much from each other in style as to make it too jarring. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I feel like even when the style is different, the skill level is still there. You know, like they're all good artists. They're just, you know, a little bit of different types of polish, you know, different sensibilities, you know? And I think for me, understanding that style is not better or worse, style is different, I think gives me a little bit of an edge on being able to pick out who's right for what parts. Whereas people that just see it as linear, like you just are a better artist or a less good artist, like they don't get that, you know?
Yeah.
And there's something lacking in that understanding.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, I mean, that, so you don't believe that there's sort of, like, I know everyone is like, it's a thing that's come up in the past several years where it's like, art is objective. Like, there's obviously, you know, some people like some things and some people don't. But I mean, to me, I definitely do believe that there is an objective, like, there is a level of professional quality that you can look at and go like, yes, this person knows like what's going on. Like, I think, right? Like, I mean, I think that exists as well.
So my good friend Tess, who also has done work on Act 3, she has this really cool system of like categorizing spectrums.
Oh, really?
And one thing that she did was this spectrum of art where it's like, more or less realistic, and then like left or right would be like more, or it would be like one angle, right? Like up and down would be like more or less realistic texture, and then left and right would be like more or less realistic line art, or like, you know, shape language. And so someone might have very realistic texturing and very realistic shape language. Someone might have very expressive texturing and very expressive shape language. And then there's other people who are like super realistic texturing, but very, you know, expressive shape language. And so like you have this spectrum, right? But now we could talk about that in terms of how to pinpoint where someone's style is on this wheel, you know?
Yeah.
You could add in closer or further from the center how experienced and polished someone is in their style.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So what your style is, isn't good or bad. And how experienced you are isn't good or bad. That's just, you know, how long have you been doing it? How many hours have you put in?
Yeah.
Right. None of that's good or bad. It's just where you are at.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
So like your style is completely just a subjective choice. It's just like, well, I want to do this. I want my work to have more realistic shapes, but less realistic textures, you know, like, cool. That's your style. And you're like, well, I've been doing it for 3 years. Cool. That's your level of experience. I try to get people that clearly have been drawing for a very, very long time and have put in many, many hours, regardless of age or like professional, you know, experience. Like if someone's like, hey, I'm kind of new to doing this for other people, but I've been drawing forever, like I might have a better time with someone like that than someone that's like, yeah, I'm good at business, but I'm new at drawing. You know what I mean? Because I'm willing to work with people. I'm willing to exchange information and coach people and check in on people. And, you know, I can give people that gentle hand.
Sure.
And I think that from what I see, sometimes people are very complaining in their Facebook statuses. And I see a lot of other colleagues being like, oh, if you're an artist, don't ever do this. You're wasting my time, blah, blah, blah. And
so
like,
that's interesting.
Whoa, dude, that's your status? Like, calm down, man. You're making every artist wonder if you're talking about them.
Well,
and that's not good, you know?
Well, that's interesting because I know that in the past you said, like, you worked with Neil Adams for a while, like, right? And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering mm-hmm. about your experience with that because I know that sometimes Neil Adams would be, like, really harsh on like artists and be like, I mean, I've spoken to people who've been like, he's like, oh, just give it up. Don't like, you know, you're and you know, they continued and they found their own like success. And like, I like that you are coming at it from a different sort of angle. Like, you know what I mean? I've never asked you about that experience about working with him because that's your own private, and this is not, has nothing to do with like Neil Adams. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But I know that like, And I'd read articles where I was like, where this guy is like highly accomplished and Neil Adams is still giving him a hard time. And I'm like, really, dude? Like, come on. Like, so
yeah, totally.
It sounds like you may have learned to maybe go the other way or as to whether that is a realistic idea of what Neil Adams, how he approached people. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to stay as diplomatic as possible, I'll say, yes, I've heard those stories.
gotcha.
You know, and for whatever reason, from the first day I started working for him till the last day that I saw him, he never really was a dick to me.
Gotcha.
He was always really nice. Sometimes that actually made me feel bad. I'm like, why are you
being so nice to me?
And you're really nice to me. Like, what?
Yeah. Please
and
be
so
mean to
I'll
me.
Never
yeah.
know that. That's an interesting thing that I'll always ponder.
Yeah.
But I also had another mentor who was always just super encouraging to me. And, you know, I've found that people who know how to find what will make me feel good about myself and like blow on that ember are going to inspire the best work out of me. I know that to be true. I know when you take someone who's working on something for you, no matter what they say, they're going to be nervous. They're going to have fear. They're going to feel like they might screw it up or they don't know what they're doing. Like that's just part of art. Part of art is feeling bad. It's feeling scared. You know, that's just how it is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you do it because you love it, right? But it's scary. Yeah. And when someone can encourage you to feel good about your strengths and also be honest with you about how to improve on your weaknesses, you're going to feel good about it. You're going to feel safe. You're going to feel confident. You're going to do your best work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I pay someone money to do work for me and then berate them and belittle them and make them less, you know, confident and feel less good and give me subpar work. Like, that's nonsense. Yeah, like, that's absolutely self-defeating. And it's mean. It's just shitty. You know, like, I don't want to be a shitty person.
Even
if I fail at everything, I still don't want to be a shitty person. Period.
Sure.
But well, then also, it's, like, more successful to, like, lift people up and make them feel good and boost them, fill their battery. Agreed. You know, like,
yeah,
like you're going to get better work out of people. So I'm always trying to make sure that I'm getting the best work out of people. Right. So when I write, I tend to give enough information about what is happening that the artist reading this can know what's happening and envision it themselves. I don't micromanage with angles or, you know, compositions or anything like that, unless it's important to the plot. Mm. Like, hey, we need to be able to see this, but we can't see that part yet because that comes up later. The only time I'll ever talk about angles or compositions is when it's important to the plot, and that's it. The rest of the time, I'm like, hey, I hired you to do this. I want to see what you do. Give it to me in your vision.
Yeah.
Because the biggest thing I know is when people like hire me to do freelance work or whatever, the more they want me to do their vision, the less good my work is going to be because it's not my vision. I'm not seeing it. I'm trying to do what I think they want. And that is just never going to be as good.
Yeah.
But the more someone's like, hey, dude, I love your art. I trust you. That's why I hired you. I hired you because I like your art and I trust you. Do this and go. You know, that's when I'm like, cool, I get to shine. I get to put my heart into it. That's when I'm going to do my best work. I know that. So that's how I try to treat other people. It's like super not micromanaging. And I think most of the artists that I work with are like, wow, I've never worked with someone that was so easy to work with before. You know, like I get good feedback a lot about the way I work with people. But it's also because as an artist, I understand like, hey, don't breathe down my neck. Don't look over my shoulder. Don't micromanage me. Don't, you know, try to make me draw your vision. Like, it's not our relationship here. You know, you're hiring me because of my art. Let me do my art, you know?
Yeah.
So giving people that is really helpful, I think. Yeah. And it helps people feel invested, you know?
Yeah. And as far as like, as an artist writing a script, like, are you doing full script, like panel per panel, like page, like not Marvel style, excuse me, what people consider DC style, like that sort of thing?
Like I do full every panel. And then what the action in that panel is, what the dialogue and sound effects in that panel is. And I, you know, I script out the entire, every page that way.
Nice.
Very cool. I try to keep my scripts to one page per page, you know, like.
Oh, got it.
You're not and that's Alan actually Moore a writing really like... good
yeah.
benchmark for me. Because like, if one page of script is one page of comic, I know that I'm not using too many words, which for visual thinkers can be really difficult. Yeah. You know, like when you get like five paragraphs of something that could have been said in a sentence and you're a visual thinker, you're like, my brain is swimming, trying to divine what's important about this. That's the writer's job. The writer should be like, hey, here's what's important. Here's what you need to know.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're a good writer, freaking act like you're, you know, like you have to buy a vowel and like each vowel costs money, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do. And I think it works really well for the artists, you know?
And I
think that speaks for itself because there's some great freaking art in this series.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, cool. Well, thank you very much for your time. I know you got to get back to your convention to go sell books, you know, the good fight.
Can I just keep talking to you all day?
We can talk all day if you want. I mean, I can talk to you. I mean, I mean, we have good chats whenever you come on. So, but again, the book is called Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter. Issues 1-3 are available right now on Kickstarter.com. Go support the book. JL Draco, any final thoughts on like Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter or anything else in general? Vote Biden.
Just that the third one is definitely like I think they get better as they go. Like
excellent.
The first one is great, the second one is better, and the third one is like, you know, it's definitely just get it. Yeah. Go get it.
And where can people find you online?
Onesipress.com.
Oh,
Onesipress.com is our site.
Yeah.
So you can go to Onesipress.com and get on our newsletter and find out about everything we're doing. Get tons of freebies. We're always giving out freebies. But also for right now, and anytime we're running a Kickstarter, we always use the same link that's a redirect to whatever our current Kickstarter is. So that's always going to be kickstarter.oneshipress.com. oneshipress.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, if you like Deadpool, if you like the old like John Byrne, She-Hulk thing, which I do, that's...
I love it.
Yeah, whenever... So good. Yeah, this book is definitely up your alley. It's Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter, currently on Kickstarter. Thank you again, JL Draco. I always love chatting with you, and it's always like a great conversation. So thanks for joining me.
I really appreciate it. So glad to be back. I will talk to you anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, my name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Still on Facebook, still on Instagram. Have long ago abandoned the hellscape that is Twix. I also have a little hobby comic called The Periwinkle Puss, which is periwinklepuss.com. I just started posting new pages. It goes up every couple of years. Like, I'm doing it on my own. It's just fun. But you should check out Mr. Guy Zombie Hunter on Kickstarter. Thank you very much, JL Draco. I really appreciate your time. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Part-time fanboy.com.